Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 3rd of July, these are our main stories. The European Union has nominated candidates for its top leadership posts. Moscow admits 14 Russian submariners are dead in a fire on board their vessel in the Arctic. And a state of emergency is declared in Siberia due to deadly flooding. Also in this podcast, Syrian women take to the London stage to tell stories of their imprisonment.
I was exhausted from the torture, and I wanted to let my family know that I was alive.
And a gang of thieves makes off with a wine collection worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. After days of political deadlock, the 28 member states of the European Council have agreed on their nominations for the EU's top jobs. Announcing the results, the outgoing Council President, Donald Tusk, praised the gender balance that was achieved.
We have chosen two women and two men for the four key positions. A perfect gender balance. I am really happy about it. After all, Europe is a woman.
Belgium's Prime Minister Charles Michel has been nominated as the next President of the European Council. He spoke about the challenges Europe still faces.
It's a great honour for me to be elected as President of the EU Council. Europe is facing challenges, and in my opinion, these challenges are also opportunities. And I am convinced that it will be very important to protect our unity, our diversity, and especially also our solidarity.
The Commission President nominee is the German Defence Minister, Ursula von der Leyen. I asked our correspondent in Brussels, Gavin Lee, what it took for the EU to agree on her nomination for the top job.
They've been discussing the possible Commission President for weeks because they couldn't agree on previous names. That's the German Defence Minister, the first female German Defence Minister, now set to be appointed the first female President of the European Commission, subject to the European Parliament voting on her. Incredible, actually, because all countries apart from Germany voted to appoint her. Germany abstained because of domestic politics, whereby the opposition socialist leader, Martin Schulz, who was once European Parliament president, had deeply opposed her. It forced, ultimately, through Parliament in Germany, a mandate for Angela Merkel not to vote for her own German counterpart. So, looks like it's Ursula von der Leyen in the top post. The President of the European Council is Charles Michel, the current Belgian Prime Minister, a good friend of the French President Emmanuel Macron, seen as a safe pair of hands, a new President for the European Parliament, which is again due to be voted on tomorrow. It's Sergei Sarchezi, who is a Bulgarian Prime Minister. We have two more names, the head of Foreign Affairs, which is Josep Borrell, the Spanish Foreign Minister, and the current head of the International Monetary Fund, which is Christine Lagarde, to be head of the European Central Bank.
It's been very difficult getting an agreement. How have the different member states reacted?
Well, Donald Tusk is the current president of the European Council and outgoing. I asked him a short while ago about what this means in terms of the future of the European Union, especially with Brexit negotiations, the first thing that the leaders will have to shape and work out the direction of. And he said, actually, in terms of unity, it will stay the same. It's not about characters, it's about the post. And in terms of the withdrawal agreement, which the British side wanted to reopen, that won't be touched either. But there were lots of wrangling here. Ultimately, it comes down to trying to balance geography, gender, the east and west, also the size of populations as well. Every single 5 years this comes along, there are always problems. At one stage, up until yesterday, Frans Timmermans, the socialist candidate, was likely to become the Commission President. And ultimately, I think for many, certainly in the room who were supporting gender balance, the top job going to a female, well, it's good news, particularly within the council here.
Gavin Lee in Brussels. The Russian Defence Ministry has said a fire on one of its submersible vessels in the Arctic has left 14 sailors dead. Information has been slow to come out, but President Putin had this to say. It's not an ordinary vessel, as we know. It is a scientific research vessel. The crew is highly professional. According to our preliminary report, 7 out of 14 of the dead are first-class captains. 2 are heroes of Russia. It is a big loss for the fleet and for the army in general.
The damaged craft has now been taken to the main base of the Russian Northern Fleet in the town of Severomorsk. I asked Olga Evshina from the BBC's Russian service what we've learned so far about the fire.
You know, that's the best question about this story, because this is a closed city. This is, you know, top secret Russian Navy vehicle. That's why it's really hard to get any information out of Severomorsk. It's hard to get any details. And, you know, Ministry of Defense is releasing something, but from the very beginning, you know, it took them roughly 24 hours to report about what has happened.
They're using the phrase submersible vehicle. What do we know about it? Is it a submarine or what's gone down?
Well, first of all, there are no official reports about what that is. But, you know, a few media citing their sources say that it's Russian Lasharik submersible. That's a military vehicle with nuclear engine. According to NATO classification, it's called X-ray. Well, if that's true, then that's one of the top, you know, that one of the most secret military Navy vehicles, which was performing top secret tasks. It's usually called a research vehicle, but, you know, that's quite often that's a cover story for intelligence operations. And, you know, not much is known, but it's known that, you know, it's really important tasks, and usually just the best out of the best officers, senior officers, were performing such tasks. For example, well, one record about official operations of Lasharik vehicle is their expedition to Arctic, where they helped Russia to claim, you know, their right to get to the Arctic oil resources.
And we're told that President Putin has been meeting the defense minister.
Yeah, you see, for Putin, it's very important to act properly this time, because 19 years ago, there was a similar incident with the Russian nuclear submarine Kursk. And then Putin was heavily criticized for his behavior. He was really distant, you know, almost no information was coming from the officials. So this time he's trying himself to perform better and trying to control the flow of information. But again, that has a downside. You know, first of all, there was this delay for 24 hours. And secondly, I already read a lot of panicking messages in social media, in the social media groups of Severomorsk, because people are scared. They heard that this is a vehicle with nuclear engine, and they are scared that it might be some nuclear contamination. They're asking millions of questions and getting no answers at the moment.
Olga Evshina. While Moscow responds to this fire, officials in Siberia have declared a state of emergency in the face of intense flooding. At least 18 people are dead after prolonged rainfall caused river levels near the city of Irkutsk to rise dramatically. This woman described her desperate escape from the floodwaters.
We were calling emergency services and asking if the water was coming. They told us, no, don't panic, don't create panic, there will be no water. So when I saw that the floods were coming, we only had 30 minutes, water was running. I grabbed everything needed, and that is what we are now left with.
Anastasia Golubeva reports from the region.
Irkutsk region has been suffering from massive floods for over a week now. This bridge in the city of Tulun was completely submerged and the surrounding houses were washed away. According to local officials, more than 9,000 people were affected by the floods and more than 3,000 homes were damaged. Local government officials say that they provide assistance and shelter for the flood victims, but here in Tulun, people say that they have not received any help so far. Many people here have lost everything. They're angry at the authorities for failing to warn them that the water levels were rising, and they say that the promised compensation of 10,000 rubles is about £100 is not enough. President Vladimir Putin visited the region a couple of days ago to see the situation for himself, but even his intervention has failed to reassure people whose homes, farms and businesses were swept away.
Anastasia Golubeva. Sri Lanka is still in turmoil over the suicide bombings that left more than 250 people dead on Easter Sunday. The authorities have now arrested 2 high-ranking officials, including the chief of police, who are accused of failing to prevent the attacks. My colleague Dan Damon spoke to Anbarasan Etarajan, our South Asia editor.
These 2 men were in charge. Pujit Jayasundara was the police chief and Hemasri Fernando was the defense secretary when the Easter Sunday bombings happened, which killed more than 250 people. And soon after the blast, there was a political blame game between President Maithripala Sirisena and the Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe. They both belonged to different political parties and they were trying to blame each other, and both said the intelligence warning, three warnings from India came and they were not given these intelligence warnings in advance. If they had known earlier, then they would have taken action, immediate action. And then the president asked the police commander to resign, and then he was sent on leave because he didn't want to resign. He was sent on compulsory leave. And then the defense secretary, Hemasri Fernando, resigned. What these two men did, they appeared before a parliamentary select committee hearing on what were the failures, how these attacks happened. They testified before the parliamentary committee, and which is, you know, appointed by the parliament, the speaker. And they said the president was not easily reachable. And in fact, the police chief said the president asked him to take responsibility and then he would resign. And later on, he would be given a diplomatic posting. Both deny the charges that they were responsible or there were lapses because of that inaction. What many people would see this as these two men are being made as a scapegoat. However, the president's side would say, no, the Presidential Commission of Inquiry found that these two men did not take enough action, and that's why the police are now taking action following this commission of inquiry.
And what might be the outcome?
Now, these two men can, you know, they have the opportunity to mount a legal challenge. Now, only one commission of inquiry, that is appointed by Maithripala Sirisena, who is the president, who is under intense criticism for his failure to convene Security Council meetings. And then the parliament, which is controlled by a different political alliance, and they are having their own inquiry. And that is where most of these open hearings are happening. And they are coming out and giving information how the president was not, you know, easily approachable, and we could have prevented these attacks if the president had been, you know, more communicable with the, they can communicate with the other members of the defense forces. So this political wrangling is going to continue for some more time, and the president wants to show that he is taking action, he is in charge. But some would see that as, you know, this is part of a revenge because these two men went and appeared in front of parliamentary committee, which the president doesn't approve of. And he says that this committee should be disbanded because he already has one inquiry commission. So these men are being made as a scapegoat. That is how many people would view. But at the, you know, the bottom line is there were three warnings, and the Sri Lankan missionary, the administration, did not take note of that, did not take that note very seriously. In fact, one of them came 2 hours before the attacks that some of the churches will be targeted. And then this political game will disappoint many Sri Lankans because they want to get to the bottom of this story and then find out how these eight people, Muslims from Sri Lanka, managed to get through, you know, this huge amount of explosives, come into churches and five-star hotels and carried out the carnage.
Anne Barasan Etarajan speaking to Dan Damon. In June, Europe was hit with one of the most significant heat waves of recent history. Last week, France recorded its all-time highest temperature of almost 46 degrees Celsius. Now, meteorologists have said those soaring temperatures are more likely to happen in future as a result of climate change. Our environment analyst Matt McGrath reports.
Attention, canicule. Pour éviter le coup de chaleur et la déshydratation,
a campaign by the French government advising its citizens on how to cope with rising temperatures as the country last week experienced an unprecedented June heatwave. In the south, temperatures reached 45.9 Celsius, a new national record, beating the old mark by a massive 1.5 degrees. While a huge influx of warm air from North Africa was the immediate cause, researchers and the public alike have been asking just how much of an influence does human-induced climate change have on such events. By coincidence, a group of senior climate scientists happened to be at a conference in Toulouse. They seized the opportunity to carry out an attribution study to determine the main factors influencing the weather. They compared actual temperature observations with climate models that removed the heating caused by humans. They concluded that the probability of the heatwave was increased at least fivefold by human emissions of carbon dioxide. The lead author, Dr. Frederica Otto from the University of Oxford and the World Weather Attribution Group, says the study also showed the major differences between global warming and local impacts.
So we have 1 degree global mean temperature increase, while we see a 4-degree increase in the intensity of this heat wave. So that just shows that what actually climate change means can be very different locally from what you sort of think when you think about the global average.
Researchers stress that at current levels of climate change, heat waves like the one experienced last week could become the norm for summers by the middle of this century. Only deep and rapid cuts in carbon emissions, they argue, can avoid this outcome.
Matt McGrath. Coming up in this podcast, Sri Lanka's chief of police has been arrested for failing to prevent the suicide bombings that took place on Easter Sunday. And
Lewis Porter had £600,000 on all damage.
A missing piece of the medieval Lewis chess set is sold at auction for more than $900,000. Princess Haya bint Al Hussein, a wife of the ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed Al Maktoum, is hiding in London and said to be in fear for her life after fleeing her husband. It's a situation that could pose a diplomatic headache for the UK, which has close ties to the UAE. Dan Damon asked our security correspondent Frank Gardner for the details.
It certainly sounds like she is staying in an £85 million, roughly $110 million townhouse, very close to Kensington Palace, in a very exclusive part of London called Kensington Palace Gardens, a house which she owns in her own right, reportedly, having fled from Dubai first to Germany and then to the UK. She was married in 2004 to the ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, and they appear to have parted pretty acrimoniously, it seems, because the ruler of Dubai has penned this very angry poem, which he's posted on Instagram. It's in Arabic, and it's although it doesn't name her personally, certainly all the Arab social media is assuming that it is directed at her. Now, she has interpreted that as a direct threat to her. She's very concerned about it. She's got a legal team. It may well be that there is a legal battle that's going to begin in the High Court. I don't know what the terms of that battle is or what they're going to be fighting over, but the fact is that she has fled Dubai. She is very fearful for her own safety because she fears being abducted. There is no comment from the UAE authorities on this, because other than to say that they don't comment on personal matters between two individuals.
A threat by poetry adds to the story. She fled by sea, is that right?
No, not exactly. We're at risk of conflating two different stories, but you're absolutely right to mention that, because there is a precedent to this, because last year, a daughter of the ruler. The ruler has several wives. This particular princess, who is a friend of the Queen's, by the way, so Princess Haya, who is daughter of King Hussein, she is his sixth wife, and she is the younger wife. She's 45. There is an older wife, 57, Princess Hind. One of the daughters by another wife posted a video, which you may remember, somebody called Sheikha Latifa. And she said she was desperately unhappy, she was suffering abuse, and she wanted to flee palace life. With the help of a Frenchman, she fled by sea from Dubai to India. She got as far as the coast just off Mumbai, where she was intercepted by, we were told, commandos, but basically armed mercenaries, and returned to Dubai. And there was then this very strange scene where Mary Robinson, the former Irish president, endorsed the Dubai view that she'd actually been rescued from an abduction. That appears now to be perhaps something a bit more sinister.
Frank Gardner speaking to Dan Damon. One of the most talked about new plays on the London stage is Ex Adra, featuring stories of torture and brutality in Syrian prisons. But the women who star in Ex Adra are not professional actors. They are former prisoners detained by the government of Bashar al-Assad at various points over the past three decades. Rodri Davis went to meet them.
During my detention, they forced me to do a televised confession, confessing that we organised demonstrations. The only thing I wanted was to put an end to my torture.
Mariam Haid is recounting her experiences at the hands of Syrian interrogators. She was jailed for a year for her involvement in the country's revolution, sparked during the Arab Spring in 2011.
I agreed to film because I was exhausted from the torture, to be honest. And I wanted to let my family know that I was alive.
Mariam speaks of being in a small room with up to 37 women and her torturer dousing her in freezing water, hanging her from her wrists and beating the soles of her feet. Mariam is one of six female Syrian former prisoners relating their experiences in the play Ex Adra. They've brought the performance to London for the Shabak Festival of Arabic Culture. Hendal Khawaji is another performer whose first of two imprisonments was in the 1980s for being a member of the Communist Party.
The minute you say the word prison, I immediately feel constrained. You are underground, there is no light, there is no life, and I always felt as if it were a slow death. The reason why I ended up in prison the first time was because I wanted something better. I wanted a better life. That's why when the revolution started, I was fully, fully supportive, and I was extremely happy. I felt like we had just started.
Director Ramzi Shaker found the cast members to tell a story about the strength of women.
I chose them because they each overcame the severe challenges they were facing. And even after they left prison, they were all very committed to the dreams and ambitions they had had before. So they all expressed exemplary resilience and patience. In the cast, there is only one woman who is a real political activist. The others are women who were never involved in politics before the revolution. They are students and housewives and people absolutely unrelated to the politics until the revolution.
The women have found performing a release.
When we started working on this play, it was the first time that I actually spoke about my experience in prison, because until then, people were always running away from me. No one ever asked me what my experience was like. No one ever cared to listen. So when we sat together and started to tell our stories, we were laughing and crying when we heard them, because until then, I hadn't told anyone about my experience.
That report compiled by Rodri Davis. In 1964, a Scottish antiques dealer bought a battered chess piece for about $6. The tiny ivory carving sat in a drawer for much of the past five decades. But earlier this year, the antique dealer's grandchildren learned their family heirloom was a missing piece of the medieval Lewis chessmen. Now the piece has sold at auction in London for more than $900,000. Leisha Santarelli reports.
Lewis bought it at £600,000 on all double.
The small figure of a male soldier, no taller than the palm of my hand, is missing an eye and looks quite grubby. Its white ivory worn down to a muddy brown. It has set a new auction record for a medieval chess piece. He is one of the Lewis chessmen, dating back to the 13th century and considered one of the most important symbols of European civilization. Alexander Kader is Sotheby's co-worldwide head of European sculpture and works of art.
These are real characters. You know, the king sitting nobly in his seat, the queen, the marvellous queens with their holding their hand up against their faces, looking very glum and sad. They each have a character. So I think people love them because they're very human in a way.
The medieval standing warder is a rook or castle in modern chess terms. It is one of five pieces that have been missing for nearly 200 years, but was discovered in a drawer in a family home in Scotland. And that's what made today's auction so special. It is incredibly rare for Lewis chessmen to be found and then sold on to private hands. 93 pieces were unearthed on the Isle of Lewis in 1831 and make up hugely popular displays at the British Museum in London and the National Museum in Edinburgh. It is not known if this valuable piece will be gifted to a museum to help complete their sets. An anonymous phone bidder won the auction, so for now at least, the whereabouts of this historic artefact will once again be a mystery.
Leisha Santarelli. When you think of a night out in Paris, chances are you imagine a bistro serving up fine and probably expensive wines. That image seems to have tempted a gang of thieves in the French capital who stole up to $680,000 worth of wine from a restaurant. Daniel Mann reports.
Maison Rostand, near the Arc de Triomphe, describes its wine list as one of the richest in Paris, offering diners masterpieces of the French wine art. It includes bottles from the Petrus and Romani Conti vineyards, which make some of the world's most expensive wines. On Monday, thieves managed to bore a 50-centimetre hole into a wall at the restaurant, which has two Michelin stars. They stole at least 150 bottles of wine from the cellar that's currently under renovation. In 2017, 69 bottles of whiskey worth nearly $800,000 were stolen from a luxury boutique in Paris. And 10 years ago, a man was arrested on suspicion of stealing more than 500 bottles of fine wine from some of the city's best restaurants.
And you won't be surprised to learn that police have opened a case. Daniel Mann with that report. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.